This is Audible.
Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Perfume, The Story of a Murderer, by Patrick Zuskind. Translated from the German by John E. Woods. Originally published in German as Das Parfum. Read by Nigel Patterson. Part 1. In 18th century France, there lived a man who was one of the most gifted and abominable personages in an era that knew no lack of gifted and abominable personages. His story will be told here. His name was Jean-Baptiste Grenouille, and if his name, in contrast to the names of other gifted abominations, de Sade's, for instance, or Saint-Just's, Fouché's, Bonaparte's, and so on, has been forgotten today, it is certainly not because Grenouille fell short of those more famous blackguards when it came to arrogance, misanthropy, immorality, or, more succinctly, to wickedness, but because his gifts and his sole ambition were restricted to a domain that leaves no traces in history, to the fleeting realm of scent. In the period of which we speak, there reigned in the cities a stench barely conceivable to us modern men and women. The streets stank of manure, the courtyards of urine, the stairwells stank of mouldering wood and rat droppings, the kitchens of spoiled cabbage and mutton fat, the unaired parlours stank of stale dust, the bedrooms of greasy sheets, damp feather beds, and the pungently sweet aroma of chamber pots. The stench of sulphur rose from the chimneys, the stench of caustic lies from the tanneries, and from the slaughterhouses came the stench of congealed blood. People stank of sweat and unwashed clothes. From their mouths came the stench of rotting teeth, from their bellies that of onions, and from their bodies, if they were no longer very young, came the stench of rancid cheese and sour milk and tumorous disease. The rivers stank, the marketplaces stank, the churches stank. It stank beneath the bridges and in the palaces. The peasant stank as did the priest, the apprentice as did his master's wife. The whole of the aristocracy stank. Even the king himself stank, stank like a rank lion, and the queen like an old goat, summer and winter. For in the 18th century there was nothing to hinder bacteria busy at decomposition. And so there was no human activity, either constructive or destructive, no manifestation of germinating or decaying life, that was not accompanied by stench. And of course the stench was foulest in Paris, for Paris was the largest city of France. And in turn there was a spot in Paris under the sway of a particularly fiendish stench, between the Rue aux Fers and the Rue de la Ferronnerie, the Cimetière des Innocents, to be exact. For 800 years, the dead had been brought here from the Hôtel Dieu and from the surrounding parish churches. For 800 years, day in, day out, corpses by the dozens had been carted here and tossed into long ditches, stacked bone upon bone for 800 years in the tombs and charnel houses. Only later, on the eve of the Revolution, after several of the grave pits had caved in, and the stench had driven the swollen graveyard's neighbours to more than mere protest and to actual insurrection, was it finally closed and abandoned. Millions of bones and skulls were shovelled into the catacombs of Montmartre, and in its place a food market was erected. Here, then, on the most putrid spot in the whole kingdom, Jean-Baptiste Grenouille was born on July the 17th, 1738. It was one of the hottest days of the year. The heat lay leaden upon the graveyard, squeezing its putrefying vapour, a blend of rotting melon and the fetid odour of burnt animal horn, out into the nearby alleys. When the labour pains began, Grenouille's mother was standing at a fish stall in the Rue aux Fers, scaling whiting that she had just gutted. The fish, ostensibly taken that very morning from the Seine, already stank so vilely that the smell masked the odour of corpses. Grenouille's mother, however, perceived the odour neither of fish nor of the corpses, for her sense of smell had been utterly dulled, besides which her belly hurt, and the pain deadened all susceptibility to sensate impressions. She only wanted the pain to stop. She wanted to put this revolting birth behind her as quickly as possible. It was her fifth. She had effected all the others here at the fish booth, and all had been stillbirths or semi-stillbirths, for the bloody meat that emerged had not differed greatly from the fish guts that lay there already, nor had lived much longer, and by evening the whole mess had been shovelled away and carted off to the graveyard or down to the river. It would be much the same this day, and Grenouille's mother, who was still a young woman, barely in her mid-twenties, and who still was quite pretty, and had almost all her teeth in her mouth, and some hair on her head, and, except for gout and syphilis and a touch of consumption, suffered from no serious disease, who still hoped to live a while yet, perhaps a good 5 or 10 years, and perhaps even to marry one day, and as the honourable wife of a widower with a trade or some such, to bear real children, Grenouille's mother wished that it were already over. And when the final contractions began, she squatted down under the gutting table and there gave birth, as she had done 4 times before, and cut the newborn thing's umbilical cord with her butcher knife. But then, on account of the heat and the stench, which she did not perceive as such, but only as an unbearable, numbing something, like a field of lilies or a small room filled with too many daffodils, she grew faint, toppled to one side, fell out from under the table into the street, and lay there, knife in hand. Tumult and turmoil. The crowd stands in a circle around her, staring. Someone hails the police. The woman with the knife in her hand is still lying in the street. Slowly she comes to. What has happened to her? Nothing. What is she doing with that knife? Nothing. Where does the blood on her skirt come from?
From the fish.
She stands up, tosses the knife aside, and walks off to wash. And then, unexpectedly, the infant under the gutting table begins to squall. They have a look, and beneath a swarm of flies and amid the offal and fish heads, they discover the newborn child. They pull it out. As prescribed by law, they give it to a wet nurse and arrest the mother. And since she confesses, openly admitting that she would definitely have let the thing perish, just as she had with those other four, by the way, she is tried, found guilty of multiple infanticide, and a few weeks later decapitated at the Place de Grève. By that time the child had already changed wet nurses 3 times. No one wanted to keep it for more than a couple of days. It was too greedy, they said, sucked as much as 2 babies. Deprived the other sucklings of milk, and them, the wet nurses, of their livelihood, for it was impossible to make a living nursing just 1 babe. The police officer in charge, a man named Lafosse, instantly wearied of the matter and wanted to have the child sent to a halfway house for foundlings and orphans at the far end of the Rue Saint-Antoine, from which transports of children were dispatched daily to the great public orphanage in Rouen. But since these convoys were made up of porters who carried bark baskets, into which, for reasons of economy, up to 4 infants were placed at a time, since, therefore, the mortality rate on the road was extraordinarily high, since, for that reason, the porters were urged to convey only baptized infants, and only those furnished with an official certificate of transport to be stamped upon arrival in Rouen, since the babe Grenouille had neither been baptized nor received even so much as a name to inscribe officially on the certificate of transport, since, moreover, it would not have been good form for the police anonymously to set a child at the gates of the halfway house, which would have been the only way to dodge the other formalities, thus, because of a whole series of bureaucratic and administrative difficulties that seemed likely to occur if the child were shunted aside, and because time was short as well, Officer Lafosse revoked his original decision and gave instructions for the boy to be handed over on written receipt to some ecclesiastical institution or other, so that there they could baptize him and decide his further fate. He got rid of him at the cloister of Saint-Merry in the Rue Saint-Martin. There they baptized him with the name Jean-Baptiste. And because on that day the prior was in a good mood, and the eleemosynary fund not yet exhausted, they did not have the child shipped to Rouen, but instead pampered him at the cloister's expense. To this end, he was given to a wet nurse named Jeanne Bussy, who lived in the Rue Saint-Denis, and was to receive, until further notice, 3 francs per week for her trouble. 2. A few weeks later, the wet nurse Jeanne Bussy stood, market basket in hand, at the gates of the cloister of Saint-Merry, and the minute they were opened by a bald monk of about 50, with a light odour of vinegar about him, Father Terrier, she said, "There!" and set her market basket down on the threshold. "What's that?" asked Terrier, bending down over the basket and sniffing at it, in the hope that it was something edible.
"The bastard of that woman from the Rue aux Fers who killed her babies."
The monk poked about in the basket with his finger till he had exposed the face of the sleeping infant. "He looks good, rosy pink and well nourished."
"Because he stuffed himself on me, because he's pumped me dry down to the bones. But I've put a stop to that. Now you can feed him yourselves, with goat's milk, with pap, with beet juice. He'll gobble up anything, that bastard will."
Father Terrier was an easy-going man. Among his duties was the administration of the cloister's charities, the distribution of its monies to the poor and needy. And for that he expected a thank you, and that he not be bothered further. He despised technical details, because details meant difficulties, and difficulties meant ruffling his composure, and he simply would not put up with that. He was upset that he had even opened the gate. He wished that this female would take her market basket and go home, and let him alone with her suckling problems. Slowly he straightened up, and as he did, he breathed the scent of milk and cheesy wool exuded by the wet nurse. It was a pleasant aroma.
"I don't understand what it is you want. I really don't understand what you're driving at. I can only presume that it would certainly do no harm to this infant if he were to spend a good while yet lying at your breast."
"None to him," the wet nurse snarled back, "but plenty to me. I've lost 10 pounds, and been eating like I was free women. And for what? For 3 francs a week."
"Ah, I understand," said Terrier, almost relieved. "I catch your drift. Once again, it's a matter of money."
"No," said the wet nurse.
"Of course it is. It's always a matter of money. When there's a knock at this gate, it's a matter of money. Just once, I'd like to open it and find someone standing there for whom it was a matter of something else. Someone, for instance, with a little show of thoughtfulness. Fruit, perhaps, or a few nuts. After all, in autumn there are lots of things someone could come by with. Flowers, maybe. Or if only someone would simply come and say a friendly word. 'God bless you, Father Terrier. I wish you a good day.' But I'll probably never live to see it happen. If it isn't a beggar, it's a merchant, and if it isn't a merchant, it's a tradesman, and if it isn't alms he wants, then he presents me with a bill. I can't even go out into the street any more. When I go out onto the street, I can't take 3 steps before I'm hedged in by folks wanting money."
"Not me," said the wet nurse.
"But I'll tell you this, you aren't the only wet nurse in the parish. There are hundreds of excellent foster mothers who would scramble for the chance of putting this charming babe to their breast for 3 francs a week, or to supply him with pap, or juices, or whatever nourishment."
"Then give him to one of them."
"On the other hand, it's not good to pass a child around like that. Who knows if he would flourish as well on someone else's milk as on yours? He's used to the smell of your breast, as you surely know, and to the beat of your heart." And once again he inhaled deeply of the warm vapours streaming from the wet nurse. But then, noticing that his words had made no impression on her, he said, "Now, take this child home with you. I'll speak to the prior about all this. I shall suggest to him that in future you be given 4 francs a week."
"No," said the wet nurse.
"All right, 5.
"No! How much more do you want, then?" Terrier shouted at her.
5 francs is a pile of money for the menial task of feeding a baby."
"I don't want any money, period," said the wet nurse. "I want this bastard out of my house."
"But why, my good woman?" said Terrier, poking his finger in the basket again. "He really is an adorable child. He's rosy pink, he doesn't cry, and he's been baptized."
"He's possessed by the devil."
Terrier quickly withdrew his finger from the basket.
"Impossible! It is absolutely impossible for an infant to be possessed by the devil. An infant is not yet a human being. It is a pre-human being, and does not yet possess a fully developed soul, which is why it is of no interest to the devil. Can he talk already, perhaps? Does he twitch and jerk? Does he move things about in the room? Does some evil stench come from him?"
"He doesn't smell at all," said the wet nurse.
"And there you have it. That is a clear sign. If he were possessed by the devil, then he would have to stink." And to soothe the wet nurse, and to put his own courage to the test, Terrier lifted the basket and held it up to his nose. "I smell absolutely nothing out of the ordinary," he said, after he had sniffed for a while. "Really, nothing out of the ordinary, though it does appear as if there's an odour coming from his diapers." And he held out the basket to her so that she could confirm his opinion.
"That's not what I mean," said the wet nurse peevishly, shoving the basket away. "I don't mean what's in the diaper. His soil smells, that's true enough. But it's the bastard himself. He doesn't smell."
"Because he's healthy," Terrier cried. "Because he's healthy, that's why he doesn't smell. Only sick babies smell. Everyone knows that. It's well known that a child with the pox smells like horse manure, and one with scarlet fever like old apples, and a consumptive child smells like onions. He's healthy. That's all that's wrong with him. Do you think he should stink? Do your own children stink?"
"No," said the wet nurse. "My children smell like human children ought to smell."
Terrier carefully placed the basket back on the ground, for he could sense, rising within him, the first waves of his anger at this obstinate female. It was possible that he would need to move both arms more freely as the debate progressed, and he didn't want the infant to be harmed in the process. But for the present, he knotted his hands behind his back, shoved his tapering belly toward the wet nurse, and asked sharply,
"You maintain, then, that you know how a human child, which, may I remind you, once it is baptized, is also a child of God, is supposed to smell?"
"Yes," said the wet nurse.
"And you further maintain that if it does not smell the way you, the wet nurse Jeanne Boussy from the Rue Saint-Denis, think it ought to smell, it is therefore a child of the devil?"
He swung his left hand out from behind his back, and menacingly held the question mark of his index finger in her face. The wet nurse thought it over. She was not happy that the conversation had all at once turned into a theological cross-examination, in which she could only be the loser.
"That's not what I meant to say," she answered evasively. "You priests will have to decide whether all this has anything to do with the devil or not, Father Terrier. That's not for such as me to say. I only know one thing. This baby makes my flesh creep, because it doesn't smell the way children ought to smell."
"Aha," said Terrier with satisfaction, letting his arms swing away again. "You retract all that about the devil, do you? Good. But now be so kind as to tell me, what does a baby smell like when he smells the way you think he ought to smell?"
"Well?"
"He smells good," said the wet nurse.
"What do you mean, good?" Terrier bellowed at her. "Lots of things smell good. A bouquet of lavender smells good. Stew meat smells good. The gardens of Arabia smell good. But what does a baby smell like, is what I want to know."
The wet nurse hesitated. She knew very well how babies smell. She knew precisely. After all, she had fed, tended, cradled, and kissed dozens of them. She could find them at night with her nose. Why, right at that moment, she bore that baby smell clearly in her nose. But never until now had she described it in words.
"Well," barked Terrier, clicking his fingernails impatiently.
"Well, it's..." the wet nurse began. It's not all that easy to say, because they don't smell the same all over. Although they smell good all over, Father, you know what I mean. Their feet, for instance, they smell like a smooth, warm stone. Or, no, more like curds. Or like butter. Like fresh butter, that's it, exactly. They smell like fresh butter. And their bodies smell like a griddle cake that's been soaked in milk. And their heads, up on top, at the back of the head, where the hair makes a cowlick, there, see what I mean, Father? There, where you've got nothing left. And she tapped the bald spot on the head of the monk, who, struck speechless for a moment by this flood of detailed inanity, had obediently bent his head down. There, right there, is where they smell best of all. It smells like caramel. It smells so sweet, so wonderful, Father. You have no idea. Once you've smelled them there, you love them whether they're your own or somebody else's. And that's how little children have to smell, and no other way. And if they don't smell like that, if they don't have any smell at all up there, even less than cold air does, like that little bastard there, then you can explain it however you like, Father, but I... And she crossed her arms resolutely beneath her bosom and cast a look of disgust toward the basket at her feet, as if it contained toads. I, Jeanne Boussy, will not take that thing back. Father Terrier slowly raised his lowered head and ran his fingers across his bald head a few times, as if hoping to put the hair in order, passed his finger beneath his nose, as if by accident, and sniffed thoughtfully. Like caramel, he asked, attempting to find his stern tone again. Caramel! What do you know about caramel? Have you ever eaten any?
Not exactly, said the wet nurse. But once I was in a grand mansion in the Rue Saint-Honoré, and watched how they made it out of melted sugar and cream. It smelled so good that I've never forgotten it.
Yes, yes, all right, said Terrier, and took his finger from his nose. But please hold your tongue now. I find it quite exhausting to continue a conversation with you on such a level. I have determined that, for whatever reason, you refuse to nourish any longer the babe put under your care, Jean-Baptiste Grenouille, and are returning him herewith to his temporary guardian, the cloister of Saint-Merry. I find that distressing, but apparently I cannot alter the fact. You are discharged. With that, he grabbed the basket, took one last whiff of that fleeting, woolly, warm milkiness, and slammed the door. Then he went to his office. 3. Father Terrier was an educated man. He had not merely studied theology, but had read the philosophers as well, and had dabbled with botany and alchemy on the side. He had a rather high opinion of his own critical faculties. To be sure, he would never go so far as some, who questioned the miracles, the oracles, the very truth of Holy Scripture, even though the biblical texts could not, strictly speaking, be explained by reason alone, indeed often directly contradicted it. He preferred not to meddle with such problems. They were too discomforting for him, and would only land him in the most agonizing insecurity and disquiet. Whereas, to make use of one's reason, one truly needed both security and quiet. What he most vigorously did combat, however, were the superstitious notions of the simple folk, witches and fortune-telling cards, the wearing of amulets, the evil eye, exorcisms, hocus-pocus at full moon, and all the other acts they performed. It was really quite depressing to see how such heathenish customs had still not been uprooted, a good 1,000 years after the firm establishment of the Christian religion. And most instances of so-called satanic possession, or pacts with the devil, proved on closer inspection to be superstitious mummery. Of course, to deny the existence of Satan himself, to doubt his power, Terrier could not go so far as that. Ecclesiastical bodies other than one small ordinary monk were assigned the task of deciding about such matters touching the very foundations of theology. But on the other hand, it was clear as day that when a simple soul like that wet nurse maintained that she had spotted a devilish spirit, the devil himself could not possibly have a hand in it. The very fact that she thought she had spotted him was certain proof that there was nothing devilish to be found,
for the devil would certainly never be stupid enough to let himself be unmasked by the wet nurse, Jeanne Bussy. And with her nose, no less, with the primitive organ of smell, the basest of the senses, as if hell smelled of sulphur and paradise of incense and myrrh. The worst sort of superstition, straight out of the darkest days of paganism, when people still lived like beasts, possessing no keenness of the eye, incapable of distinguishing colours, but presuming to be able to smell blood, to scent the difference between friend and foe, to be smelled out by cannibal giants and werewolves and the Furies, all the while offering their ghastly gods stinking, smoking, burnt sacrifices. How repulsive! The fool sees with his nose, rather than his eyes, they say, and apparently the light of God-given reason would have to shine yet another 1,000 years before the last remnants of such primitive beliefs were banished. Ah, yes, and you poor little child, innocent creature, lying in your basket and slumbering away with no notion of the ugly suspicions raised against you. That impudent woman dared to claim you don't smell the way human children are supposed to smell. Well, what do we have to say to that? Poopy-doo. And he rocked the basket gently on his knees, stroking the infant's head with his finger and repeating poopy-doo from time to time, an expression he thought had a gentle, soothing effect on small children. You're supposed to smell like caramel. What nonsense. Poopy-doo. After a while he pulled his finger back, held it under his nose, and sniffed, but could smell nothing except the choucroute he had eaten at lunch. He hesitated a moment, looked around him to make sure no one was watching, lifted the basket, lowered his fat nose into it. Expecting to inhale an odour, he sniffed all around the infant's head, so close to it that the thin reddish baby hair tickled his nostrils. He did not know exactly how babies' heads were supposed to smell. Certainly not like caramel, that much was clear, since caramel was melted sugar, and how could a baby that until now had drunk only milk smell like melted sugar? It might smell like milk, like wet nurse's milk. But it didn't smell like milk. It might smell like hair, like skin and hair, and maybe a little bit of baby sweat. And Terrier sniffed with the intention of smelling skin, hair, and a little baby sweat. But he smelled nothing. For the life of him, he couldn't. Apparently, an infant has no odour, he thought. That must be it. An infant, assuming it is kept clean, simply doesn't smell, any more than it speaks, or walks, or writes. Such things come only with age. Strictly speaking, human beings first emit an odour when they reach puberty. That's how it is, that's all. Wasn't it Horace himself who wrote, "The youth is gamey as a buck, the maiden's fragrance blossoms, as does the white narcissus," and the Romans knew all about that. The odour of humans is always a fleshly odour, that is, a sinful odour. How could an infant, which does not yet know sin even in its dreams, have an odour? How could it smell? Poopy-doo, not a chance of it. He had placed the basket back on his knees, and now rocked it gently. The babe still slept soundly. Its right fist, small and red, stuck out from under the cover, and now and then twitched sweetly against his cheek. Terrier smiled, and suddenly felt very cosy. For a moment he allowed himself the fantastic thought that he was the father of the child. He had not become a monk, but rather a normal citizen, an upstanding craftsman, perhaps, had taken a wife, a warm wife, fragrant with milk and wool, and had produced a son with her, and he was rocking him here now on his own knees, his own child. Poo-poo-poo-poo-pee-doo. The thought of it made him feel good. There was something so normal and right about the idea. A father rocking his son on his knees. Poopy-doo. A vision as old as the world itself, and yet always new and normal, as long as the world would exist. Ah, yes. Terrier felt his heart glow with sentimental cosiness. Then the child awoke. Its nose awoke first. The tiny nose moved, pushed upward, and sniffed. It sucked air in and snorted it back out in short puffs, like an imperfect sneeze. Then the nose wrinkled up, and the child opened its eyes. The eyes were of an uncertain colour, between oyster grey and creamy opal white, covered with a kind of slimy film, and apparently not very well adapted for sight. Terrier had the impression that they did not even perceive him. But not so the nose. While the child's dull eyes squinted into the void, the nose seemed to fix on a particular target, and Terrier had the very odd feeling that he himself, his person, Father Terrier, was that target. The tiny wings of flesh around the two tiny holes in the child's face swelled like a bud opening to bloom, or rather, like the cups of that small meat-eating plant that was kept in the Royal Botanical Gardens, and like the plant, they seemed to create an eerie suction. It seemed to Terrier as if the child saw him with its nostrils, as if it were staring intently at him, scrutinizing him more piercingly than eyes could ever do, as if it were using its nose to devour something whole, something that came from him, from Terrier, and that he could not hold that something back or hide it. The child, with no smell, was smelling at him shamelessly. That was it. It was establishing his scent. And all at once he felt as if he stank of sweat and vinegar, of choucroute and unwashed clothes. He felt naked and ugly, as if someone were gaping at him while revealing nothing of himself. The child seemed to be smelling right through his skin, into his innards. His most tender emotions, his filthiest thoughts, lay exposed to that greedy little nose, which wasn't even a proper nose, but only a pug of a nose, a tiny perforated organ, forever crinkling and puffing and quivering. Terrier shuddered. He felt sick to his stomach. He pulled back his own nose as if he smelled something foul that he wanted nothing to do with. Gone was the homey thought that this might be his own flesh and blood. Vanished the sentimental idyll of father and son and fragrant mother, as if someone had ripped away the cosy veil of thought that his fantasy had cast about the child and himself. A strange, cold creature lay there on his knees, a hostile animal, and were he not a man by nature prudent, God-fearing, and given to reason, in the rush of nausea he would have hurled it like a spider from him. Terrier wrenched himself to his feet and set the basket on the table. He wanted to get rid of the thing as quickly as possible. Right away, if possible. Immediately, if possible. And then it began to wail. It squinted up its eyes, gaped its gullet wide, and gave a screech so repulsively shrill that the blood in Terrier's veins congealed. He shook the basket with an outstretched hand and shouted, "Poopy-doo!" to silence the child, but it only bellowed more loudly and turned completely blue in the face and looked as if it would burst from bellowing. "Away with it," thought Terrier. "Away this very instant with this—" He was about to say, "devil," but caught himself and refrained. "Away with this monster, with this insufferable child!" But away where? He knew a dozen wet-nurses and orphanages in the neighbourhood, but that was too near, too close for comfort. Get the thing farther away, so far away that you couldn't hear it— so far away that it could not be dropped on your doorstep again every hour or so. If possible, it must be taken to another parish. On the other side of the river would be even better. And best of all, extramuros, in the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. That was it. That was the place for this screaming brat, far off to the east, beyond the Bastille, where at night the city gates were locked. And he hitched up his cassock and grabbed the bellowing basket and ran off, ran through the tangle of alleys to the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Antoine, eastward up the Seine, out of the city, far, far out the Rue de Charonne, almost to its very end, where at an address near the cloister of Madeleine de Trenelle he knew there lived a certain Madame Gaillard, who took children to board, no matter of what age or sort, as long as someone paid for them. And there he handed over the child, still screaming, paid a year in advance, and fled back into the city, and once at the cloister cast his clothes from him as if they were foully soiled, washed himself from head to foot, and crept into bed in his cell, crossing himself repeatedly, praying long, and finally, with some relief, falling asleep. 4. Madame Gaillard's life already lay behind her, though she was not yet 30 years old. To the world she looked as old as her years, and at the same time 200, 300, 100 times older, like the mummy of a young girl. But on the inside she was long since dead. When she was a child, her father had struck her across the forehead with a poker, just above the base of the nose, and she had lost for good all sense of smell and every sense of human warmth and human coldness, indeed, every human passion. With that one blow, tenderness had become as foreign to her as enmity, joy as strange as despair. She felt nothing when later she slept with a man, and just as little when she bore her children. She did not grieve over those that died, nor rejoice over those that remained to her. When her husband beat her, she did not flinch, and she felt no sense of relief when he died of cholera in the Hôtel Dieu. The only two sensations that she was aware of were a very slight depression at the approach of her monthly migraine, and a very slight elevation of mood at its departure. Otherwise, this numbed woman felt nothing. On the other hand, or perhaps precisely because of her total lack of emotion, Madame Gaillard had a merciless sense of order and justice. She showed no preference for any one of the children entrusted to her, nor discriminated against any one of them. She served up 3 meals a day, and not the tiniest snack more. She diapered the little ones 3 times a day, but only until their 2nd birthday. Whoever shit in his pants after that received an uncensorious slap and 1 less meal. Exactly 1/2 of the boarding fees were spent for her wards, exactly 1/2 she retained for herself. She did not attempt to increase her profits when prices went down, and in hard times she did not charge a single sol extra, even when it was a matter of life and death. Otherwise, her business would have been of no value to her. She needed the money. She had it figured down to the penny. In her old age she wanted to buy an annuity, with just enough beyond that so that she could afford to die at home rather than perish miserably in the Hôtel Dieu as her husband had. The death itself had left her cold, but she dreaded a communal, public death among hundreds of strangers. She wanted to afford a private death, and for that she needed her full cut of the boarding fees. True, there were winters when 3 or 4 of her 2 dozen little boarders died. Still, her record was considerably better than that of most other private foster mothers, and surpassed by far the record of the great public and ecclesiastical orphanages, where the losses often came to 9 out of 10. There were plenty of replacements. Paris produced over 10,000 new foundlings, bastards, and orphans a year. Several such losses were quite affordable. For little Grenouille, Madame Gaillard's establishment was a blessing. He probably could not have survived anywhere else. But here, with this small-souled woman, he throve. He had a tough constitution. Whoever has survived his own birth in a garbage can is not so easily shoved back out of this world again. He could eat watery soup for days on end. He managed on the thinnest milk, digested the rottenest vegetables and spoiled meat. In the course of his childhood he survived the measles, dysentery, chicken pox, cholera, a 20-foot fall into a well, and a scalding with boiling water poured over his chest. True, he bore scars and chafings and scabs from it all, and a slightly crippled left foot left him with a limp, but he lived. He was as tough as a resistant bacterium, and as content as a tick sitting quietly on a tree and living off a tiny drop of blood plundered years before. He required a minimum ration of food and clothing for his body. For his soul he required nothing. Security, attention, tenderness, love, or whatever all those things are called that children are said to require, were totally dispensable for the young Grenouille. Or rather, so it seems to us, he had totally dispensed with them just to go on living from the very start. The cry that followed his birth, the cry with which he had brought himself to people's attention and his mother to the gallows, was not an instinctive cry for sympathy and love. That cry, emitted upon careful consideration, one might almost say upon mature consideration, was the newborn's decision against love, and nevertheless for life. Under the circumstances, the latter was possible only without the former, and had the child demanded both, it would doubtless have abruptly come to a grisly end. Of course it could have grabbed the other possibility open to it, and held its peace, and thus have chosen the path from birth to death without a detour by way of life, sparing itself and the world a great deal of mischief. But to have made such a modest exit would have demanded a modicum of native civility, and that Grenouille did not possess. He was an abomination from the start. He decided in favour of life out of sheer spite and sheer malice. Obviously he did not decide this as an adult would decide, who requires his more or less substantial experience and reason to choose among various options. But he did decide vegetatively, as a bean when once tossed aside must decide if it ought to germinate or had better let things be. Or like that tick in the tree, for which life has nothing better to offer than perpetual hibernation, the ugly little tick, which by rolling its blue-grey body up into a ball, offers the least possible surface to the world, which by making its skin smooth and dense, emits nothing, lets not the tiniest bit of perspiration escape. The tick, which makes itself extra small and inconspicuous, so that no one will see it and step on it. The lonely tick, which, wrapped up in itself, huddles in its tree, blind, deaf, and dumb, and simply sniffs, sniffs all year long, for miles around, for the blood of some passing animal that it could never reach on its own power. The tick could let itself drop. It could fall to the floor of the forest, and creep a millimetre or two here or there on its six tiny legs, and lie down to die under the leaves. It would be no great loss, God knows. But the tick, stubborn, sullen, and loathsome, huddles there, and lives, and waits. Waits for that most improbable of chances that will bring blood, in animal form, directly beneath its tree. And only then does it abandon caution, and drop, and scratch, and bore, and bite, into that alien flesh. The young Grenouille was such a tick. He lived encapsulated in himself, and waited for better times. He gave the world nothing but his dung. No smile, no cry, no glimmer in the eye, not even his own scent. Every other woman would have kicked this monstrous child out, but not Madame Gaillard. She could not smell that he did not smell, and she expected no stirrings from his soul, because her own was sealed tight. The other children, however, sensed at once what Grenouille was about. From the first day, the new arrival gave them the creeps. They avoided the box in which he lay, and edged closer together in their beds, as if it had grown colder in the room. The younger ones would sometimes cry out in the night. They felt a draught sweep through the room. Others dreamed something was taking their breath away. One day the older ones conspired to suffocate him. They piled rags and blanket and straw over his face, and weighed it all down with bricks. When Madame Gaillard dug him out the next morning, he was crumpled and squashed and blue, but not dead. They tried it a couple of times more, but in vain. Simple strangulation, using their bare hands or stopping up his mouth and nose, would have been a dependable method, but they did not dare try it. They didn't want to touch him. He disgusted them, the way a fat spider that you can't bring yourself to crush in your own hand disgusts you. As he grew older, they gave up their attempted murders. They probably realized that he could not be destroyed. Instead, they stayed out of his way, ran off, or at least avoided touching him. They did not hate him. They weren't jealous of him either, nor did they begrudge him the food he ate. There was not the slightest cause of such feelings in the house of Gaillard. It simply disturbed them that he was there. They could not stand the non-smell of him. They were afraid of him. 5. Looked at objectively, however, there was nothing at all about him to instill terror. As he grew older, he was not especially big nor strong. Ugly, true, but not so extremely ugly that people would necessarily have taken fright at him. He was not aggressive, nor underhanded, nor furtive. He did not provoke people. He preferred to keep out of their way. And he appeared to possess nothing even approaching a fearful intelligence. Not until age 3 did he finally begin to stand on 2 feet. He spoke his first word at 4. It was the word fishes, which in a moment of sudden excitement burst from him, like an echo when a fishmonger coming up the Rue de Charonne cried out his wares in the distance. The next words he parted with were pelargonium, goat stall, Savoy cabbage, and Jacques Loreur, this last being the name of a gardener's helper from the neighbouring convent of the Filles de la Croix, who occasionally did rough, indeed very rough, work for Madame Gaillard, and was most conspicuous for never once having washed in all his life. He was less concerned with verbs, adjectives, and expletives. Except for yes and no, which, by the way, he used for the first time quite late, he used only nouns, and essentially only nouns for concrete objects, plants, animals, human beings, and only then if the objects, plants, animals, or human beings would subdue him with a sudden attack of odour. One day, as he sat on a cord of beechwood logs, snapping and cracking in the March sun, he first uttered the word wood. He had seen wood 100 times before, had heard the word 100 times before. He understood it, too, for he had often been sent to fetch wood in winter. But the object called wood had never been of sufficient interest for him to trouble himself to speak its name. It happened first on that March day, as he sat on the cord of wood. The cord was stacked beneath overhanging eaves, and formed a kind of bench along the south side of Madame Gaillard's shed. The top logs gave off a sweet burnt smell, and up from the depths of the cord came a mossy aroma, and in the warm sun bits of resin odour crumbled from the pinewood planking of the shed. Grenouille sat on the logs, his legs outstretched, and his back leaned against the wall of the shed. He had closed his eyes, and did not stir. He saw nothing, he heard nothing, he felt nothing. He only smelled the aroma of the wood rising up around him to be captured under the bonnet of the eaves. He drank in the aroma. He drowned in it, impregnating himself through his innermost pores, until he became wood himself. He lay on the cord of wood like a wooden puppet, like Pinocchio, as if dead, until, after a long while, perhaps a half hour or more, he gagged up the word, "Wood." He vomited the word up, as if he were filled with wood to his ears, as if buried in wood to his neck, as if his stomach, his gorge, his nose were spilling over with wood. And that brought him to himself, rescued him, only moments before the overpowering presence of the wood, its aroma, was about to suffocate him. He shook himself, slid down off the logs, and tottered away, as if on wooden legs. Days later he was still completely fuddled by the intense olfactory experience, and whenever the memory of it rose up too powerfully within him, he would mutter imploringly over and over, "Wood, wood." And so he learned to speak. With words designating non-smelling objects, with abstract ideas and the like, especially those of an ethical or moral nature, he had the greatest difficulty. He could not retain them, confused them with one another, and even as an adult used them unwillingly and often incorrectly. Justice, conscience, God, joy, responsibility, humility, gratitude, and so on, what these were meant to express remained a mystery to him. On the other hand, everyday language soon would prove inadequate for designating all the olfactory notions that he had accumulated within himself. Soon he was no longer smelling mere wood, but kinds of wood. Maple wood, oak wood, pine wood, elm wood, pear wood, old, young, rotting, mouldering, mossy wood, down to single logs, chips, and splinters, and could clearly differentiate them as objects in a way that other people could not have done by sight. It was the same with other things. For instance, the white drink that Madame Gaillard served her wards each day, why should it be designated uniformly as milk, when to Grenouille's senses it smelled and tasted completely different every morning, depending on how warm it was, which cow it had come from, what the cow had been eating, how much cream had been left in it, and so on? Or why should smoke possess only the name smoke, when from minute to minute, second to second, the amalgam of hundreds of odours mixed iridescently into ever new and changing unities as the smoke rose from the fire? Or why should earth, landscape, air, each filled at every step and every breath with yet another odour, and thus animated with another identity, still be designated by just those three coarse words? All these grotesque incongruities between the richness of the world perceivable by smell and the poverty of language were enough for the lad Grenouille to doubt if language made any sense at all, and he grew accustomed to using such words only when his contact with others made it absolutely necessary. At age 6, he had completely grasped his surroundings olfactorily. There was not an object in Madame Gaillard's house, no place along the northern reaches of the Rue de Charonne, no person, no stone, tree, bush or picket fence, no spot, be it ever so small, that he did not know by smell, could not recognize again by holding its uniqueness firmly in his memory. He had gathered tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of specific smells, and kept them so clearly, so randomly at his disposal, that he could not only recall them when he smelled them again, but could also actually smell them simply upon recollection. And what was more, he even knew how by sheer imagination to arrange new combinations of them, to the point where he created odours that did not exist in the real world. It was as if he were an autodidact, possessed of a huge vocabulary of odours, that enabled him to form at will great numbers of smelled sentences, and at an age when other children stammer words, so painfully drummed into them, to formulate their very first inadequate sentences describing the world. Perhaps the closest analogy to his talent is the musical Wunderkind, who has heard his way inside melodies and harmonies to the alphabet of individual tones, and now composes completely new melodies and harmonies all on his own. With the one difference, however, that the alphabet of odours is incomparably larger and more nuanced than that of tones, and with the additional difference that the creative activity of Grenouille the Wunderkind took place only inside him and could be perceived by no one other than himself. To the world he appeared to grow ever more secretive. What he loved most was to rove alone through the northern parts of the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, through vegetable gardens and vineyards, across meadows. Sometimes he did not come home in the evening, remaining missing for days. The rod of punishment awaiting him he bore without a whimper of pain. Confining him to the house, denying him meals, sentencing him to hard labour, nothing could change his behaviour. 18 months of sporadic attendance at the parish school of Notre-Dame de Bon Secours had no observable effect. He learned to spell a bit, and to write his own name, nothing more. His teacher considered him feeble-minded. Madame Gaillard, however, noticed that he had certain abilities and qualities that were highly unusual, if not to say supernatural. The childish fear of darkness and night seemed to be totally foreign to him. You could send him any time on an errand to the cellar, where other children hardly dared to go, even with a lantern, or out to the shed to fetch wood on the blackest night. And he never took a light with him, and still found his way around, and immediately brought back what was demanded, without making one wrong move, not a stumble, not one thing knocked over. More remarkable still, Madame Gaillard thought she had discovered his apparent ability to see right through paper, cloth, wood, even through brick walls and locked doors. Without ever entering the dormitory, he knew how many of her wards, and which ones, were in there. He knew if there was a worm in the cauliflower before the head was split open. And once, when she had hidden her money so well that she couldn't find it herself, she kept changing her hiding places. He pointed without a second's search to a spot behind a fireplace beam, and there it was. He could even see into the future, because he would infallibly predict the approach of a visitor long before the person arrived, or of a thunderstorm when there was not the least cloud in the sky. Of course, he could not see any of these things with his eyes, but rather caught their scents, with a nose that from day to day smelled such things more keenly and precisely. The worm in the cauliflower, the money behind a beam, and people on the other side of a wall, or several blocks away. But Madame Gaillard would not have guessed that fact in her wildest dream, even if that blow with the poker had left her olfactory organ intact. She was convinced that, feeble-minded or not, the lad had second sight. And since she also knew that people with second sight bring misfortune and death with them, he made her increasingly nervous. What made her more nervous still was the unbearable thought of living under the same roof with someone who had the gift of spotting hidden money behind walls and beams. And once she had discovered that Grenouille possessed this dreadful ability, she set about getting rid of him. And it just so happened that at about the same time Grenouille had turned 8, the cloister of Saint-Merry, without mention of the reason, ceased to pay its yearly fee. Madame did not dun them. For appearance's sake, she waited an additional week, and when the money owed her still had not appeared, she took the lad by the hand and walked with him into the city. She was acquainted with a tanner named Grimal, who lived near the river in the Rue de la Mortellerie, and had a notorious need for young labourers, not for regular apprentices and journeymen, but for cheap coolies. There were certain jobs in the trade, scraping the meat off rotting hides, mixing the poisonous tanning fluids and dyes, producing the caustic lyes, so perilous that, if possible, a responsible tanning master did not waste his skilled workers on them, but instead used unemployed riffraffs, tramps, or indeed stray children, about whom there would be no inquiry in dubious situations. Madame Gaillard knew, of course, that by all normal standards, Grenouille would have no chance of survival in Grimal's tannery. But she was not a woman who bothered herself about such things. She had, after all, done her duty. Her custodianship was ended. What happened to her ward from here on was not her affair. If he made it through, well and good. If he died, that was well and good, too. The main thing was that it all be done legally. And so she had Monsieur Grimal provide her with a written receipt for the boy she was handing over to him, gave him in return a receipt for her brokerage fee of 15 francs, and set out again for home in the Rue de Charonne. She felt not the slightest twinge of conscience. On the contrary, she thought her actions not merely legal, but also just, for if a child for whom no one was paying were to stay on with her, it would necessarily be at the expense of the other children, or worse, at her own expense, endangering the future of the other children, or worse, her own future, that is, her own private and sheltered death, which was the only thing that she still desired from life. Since we are to leave Madame Gaillard behind us at this point in our story, and shall not meet her again, we shall take a few sentences to describe the end of her days. Although dead in her heart since childhood, Madame unfortunately lived to be very, very old. In 1782, just short of her 70th birthday, she gave up her business, purchased her annuity as planned, sat in her little house, and waited for death. But death did not come. What came in its place was something not a soul in the world could have anticipated. A revolution, a rapid transformation of all social, moral, and transcendental affairs. At first, this revolution had no effect on Madame Gaillard's personal fate, but then, she was almost 80 by now, All at once, the man who held her annuity had to emigrate, was stripped of his holdings, and forced to auction off his possessions to a trouser manufacturer. For a while, it looked as if even this change would have no fatal effect on Madame Gaillard, for the trouser manufacturer continued to pay her annuity punctually. But then came the day when she no longer received her money in the form of hard coin, but as little slips of printed paper, and that marked the beginning.